This programme was previously broadcast live on Love Sport Radio, so some items may be out of date. For more podcasts or to listen live, visit lovesportradio.com.
Good evening, this is Love Sport Radio. I am Matt Beadle and you're listening to the Watford Fan Show. No Andy Lewis this week from the Hornet's Nest. He is away. And it's fair to say it's been quite enjoyable on this international break. No drama, no controversy, none of that stuff with regards to Watford SC. It's been quite a quiet week. So we've taken an opportunity this week to speak to some players past and present. We're going to not look too far ahead to that clash with Tottenham, although we do have Jamie Brown from Daily Hotspur on towards the end of the show. But we've had a bit of a goalkeeping special this week. We've taken the opportunity to speak to Ben Foster and, of course, Alec Chamberlain as well. Ben Foster in particular, of course, someone who retired from international duty, decided to not play for his country, unlike many players who are away this week. And, of course, it is National Non-League Day as well this weekend. So we spoke to Ben about that and about his surprise from playing in non-league to getting that move to Stoke City.
Yes, it was. It was a massive surprise. I was 18, well, just turned 18, actually. I was working full-time. I was just playing for a non-league team, kind of training on a Tuesday night, playing on a Saturday. You might play on a Wednesday night or something. Because obviously I was young and I was doing well, obviously the rumour mill starts and you start to hear that scouts are coming to watch you and this, that and whatever. But then when Stoke actually made a serious move for me and kind of came in and tried to buy me, it was like, wow. It's a whole kind of life change, really. You've got to give your job up, go and become a footballer full-time, training every single day. It was massive at the time and it was a lot of a sort of adjusting to it as well.
Obviously, before you went to Stoke, you were a chef.
Yes, I was, yeah. I left school at 16. Me and a couple of mates, we got jobs at a Cafe Rouge in Leamington where we live. We were obviously working full time, but we would go college sort of 2 days a week as well. It was good. It was really nice. We had a good laugh and we learned a few things along the way. So like I say, to go from that to making it as a professional footballer at the time, especially was a huge deal.
I always remember something you said to me when you were at Stoke, where you came to watch Stoke. You didn't play for Stoke, did you?
I never played.
Played for him, which was bizarre. But you came to a game, Watford versus Stoke. I was playing. You weren't playing. But watching the game, it made you think, watching me, this is your exact words you gave to me, watching me, you know what I'm going to say, don't you?
Yeah.
Watching me, it made you think, how's he playing and I'm not?
Yes.
I just remember thinking, obviously, you've got to back yourself. But I remember watching the game and thinking, surely I've got a chance. I feel like I'm a decent goalie. I just wasn't being given a chance. You know, I was, like I said, I was at Stoke. I was third choice goalie behind people like Ed De Hoy and Neil Cutler. And it just seemed to be like there was always just somebody sort of really more experienced in my way and I just couldn't get a break. The chance to go out on loan, whenever that came along, I was sort of biting at the, chomping at the bit, to get out and just to play first team football. Because even throughout my whole career, like from today to when I was 18, training, it was always nice and it was a bit of a laugh, but I never really got the sort of buzz and the adrenaline rush that I get from a match day and a Saturday afternoon.
You're obviously a pretty kind of chilled out, you're a down-to-earth guy. Do you think that's because, as you mentioned, obviously you were going to college, you were working, and there's other examples, aren't there? Chris Hughton was a lift engineer, Ian Wright used to lay tarmac, Lee Dixon worked in his dad's factory. It gives you a bit of perspective as opposed to those people who've just gone through the system and straight into the pros. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, that's the word, perspective. That gives you a massive perspective. You realise that working sort of 45, 50 hours, weeks, slogging yourself in a kitchen, it's hot, it's sweaty. You don't finish, like being a chef especially, it's the most unsociable hours because you've got to work when people aren't working, basically. That's the whole point of, people going for a meal in a restaurant. So you realise that working, you might start training at 11, finish at 1 o'clock, it's, that's all right, that, isn't it? So you go to training, you'll do that bit, but then you realise that you probably need to push yourself a little bit more. There's a bit more gym work you need to do. And if you really want to crack on in the game, that's the sort of stuff that you really need to do.
So on that note, Ben, I mean, it's fair to say you're probably one of the most down-to-earth footballers I think I've ever seen play. You're constantly smiling, you're laughing, you're having a bit of a joke with the crowd. We don't see that as commonly these days, though, do we? Especially in the top flight.
No, I think nowadays football is so scrutinised, so under the sort of magnifying glass that people are just afraid to sort of snap out of, you know, being so professional. It's almost like they have to get in a mode of, right, my job is this today. It's simple as that. It's ABC. I have to do this, that, and that, and that's it. There's no sort of alternatives to it. And it's understandable because, like you say, if I make a mistake on a Saturday afternoon, then there's probably near on a billion, 2 billion people worldwide that will see that mistake. Do you know what I mean? We're talking sort of maybe a fifth of the population of the world will see that mistake. It's insane. So you've got to have a certain level of professionalism and sort of doing it properly about it. But, you know, at my age, I've never been the most sort of professional, you know. I've always been professional, but in, you know, I don't take it so seriously, if that makes sense. You know, I understand that there's more to life than just being a footballer. Don't get me wrong, I love playing football and I know that's my job and it's given me a great life and everything else. But I know there's more to life than football, you know. It's not my be-all and end-all. So I feel I can have that kind of, you know, jokey bit about me. And it's not just on the pitch. I do it in training and I do it around the training ground. But because I can see, especially in the younger players, I can see it's so serious and so intense. And you can see them sometimes just getting bogged down with that as well. And you need to let them know that, you know, sometimes being that focused on it, it's not the best thing for you. You need to kind of take a bit of a break from it and a bit of a sort of a breath sometimes.
Do you know what? I'm going to just touch on something here and I learned a hell of a lot from you during that, certainly that year that we were together at Watford. So it was that one goal, obviously famous goal, and I'm sat opposite a Tottenham fan here and he'll remember the goal. Yeah. Obviously you conceded into Paul Robinson, but the thing that stuck in my mind was I remember sitting in the change room afterwards and I remember you were about to come in and I was so nervous because I thought you're going to come in, you know, and I thought you must be in a really bad place. You've just conceded a goal from another goalkeeper, like you're going to be in bits. But it was the way in which you come in and you were smiling and you obviously weren't happy about it. You took your football very seriously and you won player of the season that season. But it was the fact that you didn't allow a mistake to get you down that much. Like your mindset was so positive in everything you did, whereas 99% of goalkeepers, something like that happens to them, that could destroy a goalkeeper.
Yeah, it could. I think nowadays it could as well. I think nowadays it probably would do more than back in the day kind of thing. That, you know, that goal was what, 9-10 years ago? And nowadays it would be replayed so much, wouldn't it? It's an Instagram meme, it's everything. But yeah, I think that's almost my way of sort of dealing with stuff, really. I'll do the same thing if I make the best save I've ever made on a Saturday afternoon and somebody comes up to me and goes, oh mate, that save was incredible. I can't take the praise. I don't want to hear the praise. I'm just like, yeah, but you know, it's my job, you know. And if I do something bad, it's the same thing. I don't want them to come up to me and go, never mind. I'll just be like, you know, it's the way it is. And never mind. And that's almost how I look at it nowadays, whether it's good, bad or indifferent. It's never mind. Let's go on. Come on, next week, or what are we doing tonight, or what am I doing tomorrow? And that's how I feel anyway. It's the best way to deal with things and to cope with things. And but like I say, I just feel for the young lads nowadays, young people, because there's so much sort of this. They're all on media. They're all on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you know that every fan in the world basically has a portal into that footballer's life. And I think that's a bad thing. It really is.
I want to ask you about that. Actually, it just reminds me, Brad Friedel said on the show last week, his biggest advice to young goalkeepers was, you're never as good as you think you are, you're never as bad as you think you are, you're always somewhere in the middle. And it kind of touched on what you've just said there. That level-headedness, if that's even a word, is what you need as a goalkeeper. But then you mentioned that social media. That was the thing I struggled with personally, was that you have a bad game, you got on the team coach, and within seconds, you're getting tweets from people. And as much as you don't know the people and you want to ignore it, of course you see it. What's your thoughts on social media and how that's impacted you, goalkeepers and pro players overall?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. It's so hard to sort of say to it's so hard to say to somebody, listen, don't pay any attention to it, because, you know, young people now, they grow up looking at that 24/7, you know what I mean? They're glued to the phones. That's all they do. So it's so hard to say don't pay any attention to it when they've grown up paying attention to only that. So you've got to take everything with a pinch of salt. You know. So if I'm a singer or I'm a boxer or I'm an entertainer, if I'm on Twitter, most of the time, anything I'm going to get is good. It's going to be a nice bit of, you know, feedback. It's you're the best, you're this, that, brilliant. But if you're a footballer, you know that you're playing against an opposition that doesn't like you. And there's 19 other teams in the Premier League that doesn't like me. So if I play well, I'm going to get abuse from the away fans. Or if I play badly, I'm going to get abuse from not only the away fans, but football fans in general. So you can't win. You really can't win. So I know that you can't win. So I pay no real attention to it. And that's the problem with young lads nowadays. They it's almost like they need that kind of validation from the internet world of random people that they've never met and they'll probably never meet in their entire lives, but they still crave it and they need it. And that's the bit that they need to let go of, you know. Don't get me wrong, everybody's entitled to their opinions, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Their opinion doesn't matter because you're the only person that can affect how you're thinking in your brain. You're the only opinion that matters.
There is, I suppose, there's a contrary or a couple of contrary arguments to that, though, aren't there? So I was at the MTV Awards and I bumped into Paul Pogba, who was there. It was a Wednesday night. It was down at Wembley. So it was about 8, 9 o'clock at night. He was there hanging out with pop stars, who apparently he's all mates with. And he was filming it all for his Instagram story. But if you're 300 miles away from Manchester when you've got training the day after because you want to get some decent stories for Instagram, as far as I'm concerned, your head isn't in the game. But then on the other side, Jesse Lingard at the World Cup filmed a lot of stuff for Instagram, and that was part of what bridged a gap between the England players and the new generation. So is it something that maybe they, because it's part of life, they do need to embrace, but potentially some footballers let it lead them astray?
It's about finding a balance, you know. Maybe this is where when you're signing players in the first place, you need to do a bit more due diligence about the player that you're signing and find out what they're like as a person, as a character. You know, I was at West Brom for 7 years and virtually every player we signed was asked about, was found out about. What's he like in the dressing room? What's he like on this? Is he controversial in the media? Does he do this? Does he do that? And, you know, 9 times out of 10, we would sign one of the good ones. You know what I mean? You know, you'd get the odd one that slipped through the net, like James McLean, for example, who was just a liability. No, I love him to bits. So James is brilliant. He's a great lad and he speaks his mind. And, you know, he is what he is. And I don't think you could ever change him. And I wouldn't want him to change either because he's awesome. He's a great bloke. The thing is, he could just have an argument with himself and that's just who he is.
Something I want to speak to you about, Ben, obviously something I'm impressed with, given that I retired at 32 with injuries. You've had, is it 3 cruciate injuries now or 2? I lost count. It's three cruciate injuries. Yeah. From what I can see, you're as fit as you've ever been. You've obviously kept going through these injuries. I mean, what advice would you give to young goalkeepers that are picking up injuries like this?
Yeah, you need to first of all try and understand why you're getting, if it's a repetitive injury, you need to understand why you're getting that repetitive injury. There's something sort of fundamentally wrong with something, how you're made up, your mechanics is, of how sort of built really. There's usually more often than not something wrong with that. So you need to try and address that and find what it is and then work on how you can strengthen the weakened areas. The surrounding weakened areas. I know that obviously like I say, my knees, I've had 3 cruciate ligament replacements in my knees. So I know I need to daily, and I mean daily as well, work on my hamstrings, my quads, my glutes, my calves. And then not only that, I need to do all the little tiny sort of eccentric muscles, the little balance work. And, you know, the amount of balance work I do a day is insane, just to keep those tiny little muscles firing that people really don't pay that much attention to, but they're just as important as the major muscle groups like your quads and your calves and your hamstrings. That's what you need to do. But then, you know, like you get to my age, 35, you know, I know that I can't train every single day. At Watford, we play on a Saturday, we do a warm down on a Sunday, then we're off Monday, and then we train Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And I know that my body cannot deal with a four day lead into to a game on a Saturday. So when I signed, I told them, listen, this is my routine. I'm good at if I have a Wednesday off sort of thing, and I just do just pure gym work on a Wednesday. And then it's only a two sort of day training day lead into a game. And it's always worked for me, and Watford have been good enough to oblige with that and go with it, and that's working as well. So you need to sort of learn your body. I'd say to any goalkeeper, any footballer really, you need to learn your body. It's your sort of business at the end of the day, isn't it? Your body is your business. It's the only thing that's going to make you money, so you need to look after it and you need to invest in it as well.
Is it fair to say, Ben, is there an argument here that by being a goalkeeper, you've actually been able to still play football? If you'd been an outfield player with those three cruciates, do you think it would have been a struggle for you to carry on?
Oh, it's not even a struggle. I had no chance. I guarantee you, I had no chance. When I first did my first cruciate at 19 years old, the doctor, I remember him saying to me, as clear as day, saying, listen, you're a goalkeeper, you're lucky, you'll be able to keep on playing, but you're going to have to look after yourself. Because of the severity of how I did it at the time, he said, there's no way you'd be able to play. And there wouldn't have been any way, because even now my knees can swell at any given time. You know, I could do the same thing that I do tomorrow that I've done for the last 6 months, and then all of a sudden they'll swell. Do you know what I mean? Out of nowhere, absolutely out of nowhere. Just from doing my goalkeeping bit. And like I say, I'm sort of laid off half the time anyway. I have a sort of easier week than the outfield players, and I still get these little niggles here and there. So if I was supposed to go and run around for, you know, every training session, there's absolutely zero chance I'll be able to make it as a footballer. I'm very blessed that I was actually a goalkeeper, to be honest with you.
For the fans, by the fans, Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport, the Watford fan show. Something of a goalkeeper special this weekend. We have got Ben Foster speaking at the moment, and then later it is going to be Alec Chamberlain. Just continuing with Ben Foster, he spoke to myself, Richard Lee and Joe Forrester on the Goalkeepers Union podcast, which also appears on Love Sport on Saturday evenings. Next up, he discusses his international retirement and why he felt it was the right decision at the time.
It was a sort of weird time as well. It wasn't nothing to do with football at the time. It was more of a life decision, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Me and my wife had just had our second child, Louis. And I just felt like, I just signed for Birmingham at the time, and I just felt like I wasn't at home enough. And I'm from a big family anyway. I've got two brothers and a sister. We're a really sort of close unit of a family. And that's what I've been brought up on, is being part of a family. And when you're sort of spending most of the time away from home, you know, at football anyway, and then when an international break comes along, you're away for a 10-day period without seeing anyone as well. That just really affected me sort of mentally, really. And I just didn't like it. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't feel like I could give my best when I was there. So it was an easy decision, in all honesty. And like you say, coupled with the fact that at that point in my career, I'd had two cruciate reconstructions, the body was just so thankful for a rest, you know. Like I say, my knees can just swell at the drop of a hat. So the chance of having sort of a week's rest from, so, you know, if an international break comes along now, I don't train for a week. I'll have a week off of just staying at the training ground, just doing gym work, just doing this, that and whatever. But I won't go out on the grass and play football. And my body loves it, you know. It's really thankful for that. It's like a nice little recharge. You know, all the joint surfaces and stuff in my knee get a chance to sort of recover and not feel so sore. And I definitely feel like I've prolonged my career by doing it as well.
Let's talk Man United. On reflection now, how would you describe your time at Old Trafford?
An experience, mate. A really, really good experience. It was a massive learning curve for me. I feel like it came at the worst possible time in my career. You know, I'd never change anything, because I learned so much when I was there. Some of the people that I got a chance to play with, and, you know, some of the goalies I got to play with and train with and learn from. You know, Edwin van der Sar, for example, was just an absolute genius. You know, I remember him at the time, because he was obviously the number one goalie. There was nobody in the world at that time that could have did what he did for Man United as good as he could, because he was different. You know, he was the latest stage of his career. He was just literally the most calmest, laid back man you've ever seen on and off the pitch. He was incredible. He was wicked with me. You know, he was so helpful. He would show me everything, you know, explain stuff to me and try this, try that. He was brilliant. So like you say, I know on the pitch for me, it didn't work, but I will never, ever sort of regret any of it, because of all the stuff that I learned. And it's held me in such good stead going forward, not only as a footballer on the pitch, but off the pitch as well. So it's taught me so much off the pitch. because it was such a cutthroat world. Man United is a cutthroat world. They were sort of almost in their pomp at the time when I was there. And it was game after game. It was just relentless. It was absolutely relentless. And you learn how to sort of grow up and really quickly as well.
Yeah. Was being at United like no other club that you've ever been at?
No, yes, nothing like it. You can't, unless you're at one of them clubs, it's nothing like it. You know, I remember at the time at United, we were in everything. It was a 3 or 4 year spell where we literally got to the final of every competition every year. So Champions League final, you were in League Cup final, FA Cup final, you were winning the Premier League. You know, you're in the Club World Cup Championship in sort of January time when you're halfway around the world. I was literally away all the time. I remember when like I say, Louis was born. I didn't see him. Honestly, I never saw him. Like, I remember I missed the birth by about 10 minutes. And then I was away on international. I missed the birth. I was away in hotels here, there, or whatever. I must have seen him probably, you know, 5 or 6 times in his first sort of 5 or 6 weeks of life. It was just relentless, you know, and that's what you have to sort of accept of being a part of a club like Man United at that time. You were always away. You know, they stay in a hotel the night for a home game, and then if they were away in Europe, for example, on a Wednesday, they would travel on a Monday. They would train on a Monday morning and then travel in the afternoon on a Monday afternoon. So you weren't getting back till Thursday sort of morning. Sometimes you can travel back to the next day. It was just, it was relentless. And like I say, for me personally, growing up as a sort of real sort of family unit, like always been close to my family and stuff, I just couldn't deal with it. It was like, wow, what is this sort of stuff? It was hard. It was really, really hard. But, you know, like I say, it makes you grow up really quick and you have to learn everything so quickly as well.
Last couple of quick fire questions. So what is the biggest advice you give to a young goalkeeper?
Just enjoy yourself and just realise that sometimes, you know, you're going to let goals in, and you will let goals in here, there and everywhere, and you're going to make mistakes. And the main thing is to not worry about making the mistakes, is not let it affect you. Just enjoy yourself. That's all it's about, is having a good time and smiling and having a laugh with your friends. You know, I know that nowadays in academies from the age of sort of 6, 7, 8 onwards, it's an intense old game. It really is. You know, I know firsthand from my little boy, Louis. He was at West Brom Academy and Birmingham Academy for a bit as a goalkeeper. And from the age of sort of 8 onwards, it's intense. You know, they're training 3 nights a week. They've got a game here, there and wherever over the country on a Saturday. And he didn't like it. He didn't enjoy it. He didn't want to do it anymore. And I was more than happy to pull him out and just let him play on a Sunday morning with his mates. And that's what it's about. It's about having a good time and enjoying it. And that's the main thing.
What would you say your biggest ever achievement is?
But football-wise...
He wants you to say playing with him.
But... you say that, yeah. I'd say my favourite game that I've ever played in was the League Cup final with Birmingham City when we beat Arsenal. You know, I know it's only a League Cup and it's not the be-all and end-all, but it was just the fact that it meant so much to not only all the players but all the fans as well. You know, I think we were 16-1 underdogs to win the game on the day against Arsenal. And I just remember at full time the whistle going and sprinting down towards the Birmingham fans, grabbing Stevie Carr and seeing all the Blues fans just going absolutely crazy. It just I still remember this day, and it gives you goosebumps. It was awesome.
That was the exact one I had down, because I was at that game and I remember you were phenomenal. Save after save after save. You got man of the match, didn't you?
Yeah, I got man of the match. Yeah, it was awesome, wasn't it? With the wicked atmosphere, like it was packed out with fans. But just knowing how much it meant to everybody as well, because obviously I'm a fairly local lad from Leamington anyway, so I know a lot of Birmingham fans anyway. I know how much it meant to them, even to this day. You know, sort of, what is it, sort of 8, 9 years on, I could go to Philip or something, or be a Blues fan, sort of see me and he'll go, oh, thanks for what you did in the Carling Cup final. I'm like, oh, decent. Even now, do you know what I mean? It's brilliant. So, I'd say that, to be honest with you.
You talk about interaction with fans. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not so good. Obviously, being a goalkeeper, you're closest to that crowd behind the goal. I've got a feeling you must have heard some interesting insults, shall we say, over the years. Oh, yeah. and definitely had some banter back with those fans. Any interesting stories that you can remember?
Some of the stuff they say is just, oh, wow, honestly, it's ridiculous. Some of the stuff, they will say anything. They've said stuff about my dog, about my mum, my wife.
Your dog?
Some of the stuff. I hope your dog dies. And I'm thinking, come on, that's horrible.
At least they've done their research to know that you've got a dog.
I've got a dog, yeah. Some of the stuff they say is brutal. We played Wolves earlier in the season. We beat them 2-0. It was 2-0 at our time. We were up. We were playing brilliantly, honestly, really well. And obviously, I'd spent 7 years at West Brom. So West Brom Wolves is like the biggest rivalry in the Midlands, other than Villa Birmingham. So obviously, I was getting quite a bit of heat from the Wolves fans anyway. But late on in the second half, there was a few times where the ball went behind the goal and I've gone to get it and I'm getting sort of spat at, you know, your coins are getting thrown at me, you know, a few 50p's sort of winging past my head and stuff, which is not, you know, it's not acceptable, but I know it's going to happen because of my history playing for West Brom. And there's a couple of times I've looked into the crowd and I'm no more than 6 feet away, and the absolute look on some of these grown adult men is just incredible. You honestly, if you could see their face screwed up, just pure hatred and anger. And all I'm doing is just smiling and going, "You're right, mate." it was so funny. And with a couple minutes to go, we got like a free kick right in their final third. Like, and I was just turning around, looking at them, smiling, going, "Yeah, I'm not here." And they're just, it must mean the world to them. Yeah. And you just think, oh, come on, mate, there's more to it than that, mate. It's just, you know what I mean? Go home and have a good time, would you?
Do you know what? The bit that stuck out to me with that was that they've thrown coins at your head and they missed. They must have been a really bad throw.
Mate, 6 feet away as well. 6 feet. There was a few 50p coins as well. So,
happy days.
Yeah. You know, wow, like rich fans and stuff. But no, they were honestly horrible. Like the look in their faces. Fully grown adult men. You know what I mean? They probably work as like businessmen and in offices and stuff, 9 to 5 on a weekday. And then they go out on a Saturday and, you know, about couple hours of peace from the nagging wife at home, and they go and do that. It's brilliant.
From Ali to Zaha, we've got it covered. Love Sport Radio.
This is the Watford Fan Show on Love Sport. Bit of a goalkeeper theme this week. We've just spoken to Ben Foster. Next up is Alec Chamberlain. Of course, he was at the club between 1996 and 2007. He spoke to myself, Richard, and Richard Lee about his career at Watford. We start with his very, very last game.
I know. It was a pretty nerve-wracking experience even then because, you know, we'd obviously got relegated, but I was pretty creaky by that point. You know, my body was pretty much packed in. So AD probably did the right thing, and the ball wouldn't go out of play, actually, for 2 or 3 minutes, which is probably a blessing in disguise. So eventually when it did go out, I got on. Obviously, Ben got the ovation he deserved for 2 years that he'd given to Watford on loan. And it was obviously nice to go on and get a great reception, you know, to finish off my career. So all round, it worked out brilliantly. And I never touched the ball, so it was even better.
Having been in the game for so long, is that something for a pro? Do you really soak it up? When you came on, are you looking around the stadium, or is it just another game?
Well, it was a slightly different feel, obviously, but I still had the nerves, you know, that we associate with goalkeeping. I think most people do anyway. The nervous stomach, you know, the pit of the stomach, and you don't want to make a mistake. Obviously, it was 0-0. Had we been 2 or 3 up, it wouldn't have mattered. But being 0-0, you don't want to go out with a horrendous mistake in that last minute. And that's unfortunately kind of my mindset. Really, it's like, please don't mess up. And so I don't think I could really enjoy the moment until the game was over, and I think that was probably true for all the games I played. But you know, that's again more my mentality towards playing, and I suppose just wanting to do well. I don't think it was anything other than just trying to do the best for the team and best for yourself. Sort of natural kind of process, I thought, but I appreciate it. It's not always the best way to go about things now.
Now, the reason I mention it, obviously, because at Vicarage Road at the time, it was a case of out with the old, the experienced, the trusted campaigner, and in with the new, untried, untested, somewhat uncertain new number one, goes by the name of Richard Lee.
Richard had quite a few games, really, as well. So he was, he was on the way sort of thing. He wasn't a complete novice hurdler. So, no, it wasn't quite, you know, throwing an 18-year-old into the mix. And, you know, it was nice for me because I was involved still anyway with the club being the goalkeeping coach. And I obviously went on to the staff side with AD Boothroyd. So that was great. It was a nice transition. And it was obviously nice for me as well to carry on working with the lads that I'd been working with anyway. Mm.
Something I want to touch on, you just mentioned about your mindset towards goalkeeping. And I know we had a very similar mindset where it was almost a not wanting to make an error. It was the kind of avoidance of failure rather than actually going out to be the best player on the pitch. And obviously someone at that time as well, just, again, we get a lot of young listeners that listen to the show, and I know a lot that suffer with nerves and not quite sure how to approach a game. But I guess it's an example of there not being necessarily a right or wrong, where you'd have someone like a Ben Foster who was very, very confident in his ability, and he would go out expecting to be the star of the show more often than not. And I think me and you, we were probably the other end of the spectrum, where it was more a case of safety first and not wanting to make that error.
We've all got our own sort of frailties mentally. When it comes to preparation for a game, there's always, I think this, you wouldn't be human if you didn't have any kind of doubts. But obviously, you've got to get and find a way of dealing with those doubts. And for me, I sort of, those doubts disappeared as soon as the whistle went for the game. So I could be as nervous as a kitten, really, all the way through, even going out, you know, before the game. But then as soon as the whistle went, I was fine. So I think that shows that it didn't become sort of like a stage fright, as it were. It was more a natural process, and you just had to get used to how to deal with it. It wasn't a particularly enjoyable experience, but I don't think there's anything really wrong in it. If I could have been like Ben is now, I would have preferred that. I'm sure you would, Rich.
Yeah, absolutely.
But unfortunately, I don't know why, but maybe it's because I just came so far from left field, if you will, literally a field, in the farming sort of industry, into professional football, almost sort of falling into football. And I kind of went through my career, certainly the early stages, thinking, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I'm my luck sort of thing, you know. And then eventually, I suppose, when you think, well, actually, I've been doing it a few years now and, you know, nobody's stopped wanting me to play for them, so I must be doing okay. But I still couldn't lose that build-up and that nervous feeling going into the game, sadly.
You were a goalkeeper at a very different time. You know, it's no secret everyone talks about the evolution of goalkeeping now.
Yeah.
And I recall you, I mean, it was when I was first really getting into football, and I recall you and a band of goalkeepers at the time, like Bobby Mims and Bob Boulder and Mike Hooper and John Lukic, to name a few classic names from the past. Obviously, it was very different then, and goalkeepers, I think, were looked up to. But is it fair to say there's a different kind of admiration now with the likes of Alisson and Edison and Jan Oblak and Ter Stegen and Buffon? Are goalkeepers admired in a slightly different way because the game is more, I don't know, glamorous, I would say?
Yeah, I think so. I think the value of the goalkeeper has the stock has risen, shall we say. And certainly, you know, the back pass changed when I was playing. I was at Sunderland at the time, I think it was. Maybe the tail end of Luton. But obviously we sort of didn't really, or the managers and the coaches didn't really want us to try. And I think it was just a question of dealing with the ball coming back to you, getting it away from the goal, putting it in the safe areas. That was the kind of common sense approach that we had. Now, obviously, the modern way is to try and pass your way and pass through teams. Now, I think they've possibly gone too far in some divisions where I think they've been a bit unrealistic with the expectations of A, the goalkeeper, and also the outfield players, that you know, whether they're actually capable of doing it and without making regular errors, you know, leading to goals. I think it will settle down. I think, obviously, Pep coming over from Spain and introducing a lot more of this, and obviously Klopp's now doing it as well, they've changed their personnel to suit the way that they want to do it. But obviously in the lower divisions, and I've seen championship games, I've seen plenty of championship games because I scout now, and, you know, you're thinking, like, I feel sorry for some of the goalkeepers that I put under really bad pressure from, you know, really poor balls, you know, back to them. No real thought. And I think a lot of the time, I think even in my day towards, you know, the end of when the back passer came in, I think a lot of the time it's kind of an easy option for defenders to actually turn around and just put it back to you. You know, if they don't fancy it, if they don't fancy a pass, well, that's the easy ball back to you. Never mind if the centre forward's reading it and that's actually going to be down your throat as well. Mm. So I've seen it, League Two, locally, I've been to games where I've just been sitting there shaking my head, really. Mm. You know, they're splitting the box. People are pushing in because they know what they're trying to do, and yet they're still trying to force the back pass, you know, to play out. So a midfield player will come all the way back with his back to play and expect the ball to be given to him, and then the goalkeeper gives him it, and guess what? He goes straight back to the goalkeeper, and this time he's got to hit it through a not particularly fantastic surface first time, when he could have done that, you know, and been probably more accurate in the first place. Mm. So I think certainly League One, League Two, really do have to reevaluate as to whether that is, you know, sort of the best practice for them.
Well, obviously you got your chance with Watford to play at Wembley when they won the playoffs against Bolton again, bizarrely. Successive promotions under Graham Taylor, you were the hero in those semi-finals, the penalty shootout, and that's what we want to talk about, that Birmingham game. Firstly, the Kevin Poole penalty, by the way, an absolute thunderbolt against you.
Yeah, I've had a few goalkeepers score past me with Kevin Pressman did it as well. The NFA Cup replay. But Kevin Poole, obviously, he hit it into the roof of the net above me, but he struck it well, fair to say.
It was quite funny because you're both wearing exactly the same kit.
Same kit, yeah. Yeah, Lecoq Sportif, yeah. The bright green. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, I've still got that one. I've got that one framed. Obviously, that was a nice one to keep. In as much as, you know, the memories that come flooding back when you think about it. And I've got a great poster from that day where it says May 31st, 1999, a day to remember. And then it's like a collage of pictures from the day. So that's one of my treasured memorabilia things.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember it well personally, actually, because it was the season. The following season was my first season as an apprentice, actually coming to the club full time. So I remember being with my dad watching the semi-final, and yeah, crazy night. And then the final itself, of course, Wembley, Bolton. Want to just touch on Graham Taylor, actually, a bit, because obviously you worked with him for quite a period of time. And
yeah,
prior to the semi-final, am I right in saying that he got you guys to do a lot of penalty practice and he worked quite on that? He was quite forward-thinking, wasn't he, in a lot of his ways?
He was, yeah. Because we were renting our training ground, we had to get out of our training ground at Stanmore at the end of end of the football season. So we actually trained at Old Merchant Taylor's school, and you know, it was quite a lovely, like really nice, well-kept sports ground that they have there. And so we had the pitch marked out exactly the same size as Wembley.
Wow.
And we did all our training there and the build-up, obviously, because I think from the semi-final at St Andrews to the final, there's probably at least 10, 11 days. So you've got a long, long sort of period, a long build-up. But almost on a daily basis, when we did train, we always finished the session with penalties, and he made the lads take the walk from the halfway line and, you know, do it all with the whistle. So they had as good a preparation as they could. Obviously, you can't replace the stress and the pressure of the moment, but it certainly paid off because, I mean, some of the penalties that our boys took that were just inside or under the underside of the bar and everything like that. I mean, I'm sure they might not have meant to do it quite as tight as that, but there was only one that sadly missed. He just dragged it wide, you know, and everybody else hit brilliant penalties. So Kenny Jackett had given me a tip-off on Paul Furlong's penalty, so I went the way that he said, and that was probably the best of the two saves I made. That was a good strong hand to my right. And then Chris Hollands, I think his nerves just got the better of him. He didn't get a good penalty, and it was one of those. As soon as I went the right way, I knew I was going to keep it out, and we started celebrating and looking forward to Wembley.
Managers, Chambo, now you've worked with some top names over the years. We've spoken about Graham Taylor already. Bobby Robson was boss at Ipswich when you were there. And I read a lovely quote because he was also the manager who let you go when you went to Colchester.
Yes.
And at the time he said, "You're the one I think I'm making a mistake about." That must have been quite nice to hear.
It was. It was an absolute gobsmack. I was, obviously, I came late into football at 17, dragged out of sort of county football, been spotted by Ron Gray, the scout there at Ipswich Town. And I'd not had a particularly good year. You know, I played youth team football, broke my wrist as well. But really and truly, I knew in my heart of hearts that I was hadn't done enough to get a pro contract. So Bobby Robson had all the lads that were getting released up in his office at the same time. A little bit impersonal maybe, but at the same time, he went along the line, and I was literally the last one in the line. He was going along saying, "Look, you know, unlucky, you know, but, you know, such and such a club want you to go on trial there." Blah, blah, blah. And I was at the end thinking, there's nobody going to want me. You know, I'm just going back to Ramsey, you know, and go back to Ulster Farm. But he got down to me and he said exactly that. He said, "You're the one I think I'm making a mistake about." And inside, I'm thinking, "No, you're not, Bobby. You're absolutely not making a mistake. I haven't done enough, you know." But to my relief, he said that Alan Hunter's now gone up to Colchester United, who played a lot of games for Ipswich, centre half, Northern Ireland international. He'd taken the youth team for a few times when Brian Owen had been away on international duty with England. He'd obviously saw something in me that he liked, and that's why I ended up at Colchester from Ipswich. So I just had an amazing lucky break, really, which is obviously something that you need. You need to then obviously take your chance, which, you know, I had so many little sort of things that happened in that chain of events with getting released, going to Colchester, Mick then getting injured for the first time for 5 or 6 years. So all these sort of ducks were in the row, and I managed to sort of forge my career from those lucky breaks.
Giving your team a voice. Love Sport Radio.
This is the Watford Fan Show on Love Sport. We've spoken to Ben Foster and Alec Chamberlain this evening. Quite the dip back into a spot of nostalgia with Alec Chamberlain there. Some lovely stories from him, especially that of the chat and the friendship that he had with Sir Bobby Robson. We're now going to move on and look ahead to next weekend's clash with Tottenham Hotspur. This one is a big one because arguably you'd say that both clubs could do with the points. Watford, of course, without a win this season. Tottenham in their last outing losing 3-0 at the Amex, of course, against Brighton. We've had the international break. Premier League football will be back as of next weekend. And Jamie Brown from Daily Hotspur and Last Word on Spurs is now on the line to discuss the clash. Hello, Jamie.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. This is something of an intriguing matchup next week because Watford, without a win in the Premier League thus far, they are desperate for the points.
Yeah.
Spurs, that last outing I just mentioned against Brighton, there seems to be quite a lot of turmoil at the club. They are desperate for the points. What is going to happen?
Yeah, well, this is the thing at Spurs at the moment. I don't think anyone really can predict what's going to happen with results. I mean, with Brighton, they were without a win since the opening day, and they went and beat us 3-0. So really, I think anything can happen at Spurs at the moment. In terms of our form at home, it's certainly been a lot better at home. Of course, away from home, that's where we've really struggled. So I do fancy our chances at home and really against a Watford side that are struggling this year, of course, without Troy Deeney. So for Spurs, I still think this is a game that we would expect to win, even with our difficulties on and off the pitch.
Yeah, interesting. And of course, it has been the international break. And in some cases, teams don't like it because they're building momentum. In other cases, teams love it because it gives them a moment just to take their foot off the pedal, relax and regroup. In Watford's case, of course, a goalless draw with Sheffield United. Not the worst result considering Sheffield United form away from Bramall Lane. But in Spurs' case, having that break is definitely going to help, right?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, I think this is the point where, you know, we've had some really poor results, of course, Brighton, Bayern Munich, Colchester. So you just hope that this is a chance for Spurs to really reset now and Maurizio to have a think about maybe doing things differently. Now, I know it's become very clear about all the contract situations at Spurs. Obviously, players wanted to leave, the likes of Eriksen, Vertonghen, Alderweireld. So they're all players that have underperformed this season, so you'd hope that Maurizio is kind of looking at these players and maybe their levels of commitment, and he's looking to change it, because although they're perceived as being our top players and our best players, they're just not doing it at the moment. So a lot of Spurs fans are hoping that we kind of change it up a bit. So it will certainly be interesting to see our lineup against Watford. I mean, I think we'll see quite a young back four. I mean, I think we'll see Juan Foyt, Damitar Sanchez come into the defence. Just difficult to predict how Spurs can line up. I think that Giovanni Lo Celso, he's kind of touch and go at the moment, and whether he's going to be back. So I think having that new face, if he does come back, that'd be a really big boost for Spurs.
Yeah, and like I said, with regards to it being intriguing, I think you've just outlined it there, because Mauricio Pochettino doesn't necessarily have previous, I suppose, in terms of dropping those big names. It's always been quite a rigid 11, you could say, probably more so than any other team in the division, perhaps apart from Liverpool, especially now. But those big players have never really been dropped in the past. And now, like you said, if Juan Foyt comes back in, if Davinson Sanchez comes back in, that's a really big statement from Poch. Do you actually think that he will actually do that?
Yeah, it's difficult, because you would have thought that maybe after the wake-up call against Bayern, against Colchester, that he would have done it. So you've just got to hope that that it was rock bottom against Brighton, and he does now really spring some changes, because I think that that's certainly what's needed. I just think you need some younger players that are hungry to play for Spurs, that are willing to give it all, because I just think that there are a couple of players there, certainly the key ones, that have been there for too long, that are maybe getting to a certain age where it's difficult to kind of keep going week after week, year after year, and giving so much for Pochettino, because it's obviously well documented how intense he likes it for his side to play, for his side to train. So I think it's become difficult for them. So I think sticking a couple of the younger ones in there is going to be a good thing for Spurs. I mean, certainly after we conceded 10 goals in a week, I don't think it can get too much worse.
No, absolutely not. And Jamie, before you go, I don't want to pile the pressure on here or put you in a place that you don't want to be. However, if Spurs don't win next Saturday, what will happen? And is this a must win for Spurs?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's home against a side that are right near the bottom. So, of course, it's a must-win game. In terms of Mauricio's future, I think there are already a couple of fans that are questioning him. The majority of the sensible ones for me are backing him. I think a lot of people do understand it is the players and the fact that we just haven't had that chance to rebuild and kind of bring in new players to freshen things up. So I think people do understand that it's not Mauricio, it's kind of the personnel that's kind of the issue at Spurs. So I'm going to stick by him. Whatever happens, I'll still be Mauricio Pochettino in. I'm going to back him to his very last game at the club. So for me, I don't have any concerns about if we were to lose. But in terms of the season, it would be an absolute disaster if we were to lose or not pick up all 3 points.
A disaster, says Jamie Brown. Jamie, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That was Jamie Brown from Daily Hotspur, and last word on Spurs. He thinks it might be a disaster if Spurs were to lose against Watford next week. We'll be giving you all the reaction from that game next Sunday at 7 p.m. on the Watford Fan Show.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.